Thank you for downloading the Radio Cardiff Sport Podcast. For more information about the show, go to our blog,
radiocardiffsport.blogspot.com.
Well, Neville Southall, thank you very much for agreeing to speak to us today. We're here at your autobiographical launch, The Bin Man Chronicles. Why, at this point, have you decided to write your autobiography?
It's quite difficult. I've always wanted to do one, but the time was never right. And I think sometimes you can write a book too quickly in your career when things haven't actually happened. At the same time, I wanted them to for a while. And then luckily enough, I met James and we sort of clicked and it became easy to do it. Whereas before, I think it gives you time to reflect as well on what you've actually done, decisions you've made, and other people's decisions that have been made by them on you. And what you think is a bad decision by them sometimes can turn out to be a good decision. But if you wrote it at the time, my book would have been totally different.
Would you say it's a turning point?
Well, I think you just get more reflective, don't you? I've been out of football for a while now, so it gives you the time to mull over things and look at things. And I'm probably talking with James doing it, comes to some different conclusions, really.
It's called The Bin Man Chronicles. Tell us a little bit about the significance of the title.
I don't think there's been a book named by the fans before. So we had a competition because I thought, well, I played for him along there, so it'd be interesting to see what their view of me is. that's what sort of made, to be fair. But obviously, because I worked for the Bins for about 8 weeks, that seems sticks in everybody's mind for some reason. It just says what I was and what I wanted to say.
And you talk a lot about the early part of your sort of footballing life, and you very much came from the pub team scene, and then up through the lower leagues.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about that sort of development. What do you think was the most important point at that stage in your career that led you to the career that you eventually had with particularly Everton?
Someone let me be myself. I didn't try and overcoach me, I didn't try and put silly ideas in my head. And I think when I made my debut at 12 in the Man's League, it was a massive shock for me, obviously, but somebody had enough faith in me to put me for that one game. It was against my local rivals. And it was quite an ordeal for me to go through that, but after that I played football for my school under 14s in the morning when I was 12, and I played in the Man's League in the afternoon. I then played a Sunday league on a Sunday morning, and for my local sort of boys club on a Sunday afternoon. On the school team we did okay. In the afternoon we got absolutely annihilated, so I think that 8-0 was a victory for us. We used to go with my uncle, he'd have one with the old trucks. And he'd load us on the back of the truck and then just lift it. Then we ended up come trotting out because we were all the same age, sort of between sort of 14 and 16 at that time. And people would just laugh at us. But again, he didn't put any pressure on us to play certain ways. He just said, look, go out and enjoy it. And all right, I think the most we got beat was 21-0. So, but it was enjoyable, and I never came away thinking that depressed. Just because we were playing against men. And when you're 14 playing against men, it's hard work. I think it stood me in good stead, really, because I'd always played higher up. I'd always had, people to look up to, I think, in lots of ways. I mean, going through it all the time, you try your hardest, and I suppose I got plenty of practice. So it stood me in good stead for later on. And once you've dealt with that, then you've dealt with a lot of defeats. So success is good, but when you get the defeats, it's not. It's not the worst you've ever encountered.
You mentioned a lot in the early part of the book about. You never really had any ambition to be a professional footballer, so to speak. At what stage did that sort of change? Was there any particular event, or was there something that?
No, I think when I got to Bangor City, and apparently Everton had offered me a trial, but they didn't tell me that. And when I did get in the team, I wasn't doing that well, so I wasn't very happy then. I went to another team called Conway United. I'd give myself maybe a year and see what I'm in a year, and if it's not going to be, it's not going to be. But I sort of give myself a year and a half to see where I am after this. I really enjoyed myself, and lucky enough, Gwyn Williams, who was a manager, knew a lad called Johnny Williams, who'd managed Winsford United. And he said, look, have a look at him, see what you think. And I went and played a friendly for him, and the next season I signed. But again, it was good because I never trained with Winsford, I trained on my own. Because it was too much of a trek from North Wales to Winsford, especially if you don't drive. So it was always a case of get to Chester, and Peter Warburton, the secretary, picked me up, and we'd lash into the game. As soon as it finished, I'd have a quick shower, because obviously the trains don't run that late, and just get back. And if it was Manchester or anything like that, it was hard going, but it put me in a situation where English teams could see me as well. Obviously, we played all the Cheshire, Manchester, Liverpool, so it was, again, the team were full of scouts. Mm. So we're getting good preparation for later on.
Moving on to your Everton career, you talk a great deal, obviously, about Howard Kendall for obvious reasons. Tell us a little bit about, you know, the influence that he had on you and the importance of him as a man in your career.
I actually met him in a pub. First time I ever met him was in a pub. But he just bought Jim Arnold at the time, so he said he kept my name somewhere, whether he did or not, I don't know. I think after two pints, you probably forget who I was. But and then once I got to Everton, obviously he tried to take me out of the town, and that didn't work because I didn't drink. I still don't. So, but he was good. I think he knew me better than what I knew myself, and he'd just sit there, and whatever he did was never good enough. And I think he kept pushing me until one day I thought, well, I'm just going to shut you up. And the day that he came in and said, well played, I thought, actually, I've done all right today, because he just wouldn't do it. If I come off and I was chuffed a bit, he'd go, what about that throw? What about that kick? Why'd you do that? I go, why doesn't he just shut up and leave me alone? Mm-hmm. But eventually, he gets to a point where he wants you to be. Mm. And he just kept pushing me, and it was good for me, because I think he just let me get on with what I wanted to do, but what was there to sort of, with Colin, to push it into positions.
Did he sort of have that knack where he could handle different players, he'd get to know a player's personality and he would push them as he knew he could, so he'd handle different players differently?
Yes and no. If he didn't like it, he made it plainly obvious, to be fair.
Yeah.
And if he didn't rate you as a player, he made it plainly obvious. But he's got a real ruthless streak in him as well. Mm. So you know that if you do well for him and he likes you, he'd always look after you. If he didn't do so well, he wanted you out the door straight away, which I think is fair enough, and I think that reflects on the city itself. If Liverpool people don't like you, they get rid of you as soon as you can.
So what would you say was your favourite save that you made in your career?
I didn't have one. I'm sure that I didn't have one, because I thought the next one would be better. And then I reached the end of my career and thought, there's no more. Honestly, because I always believed that I'd make a better save, and I always expected to make good saves. Because I trained hard and I worked as hard as I possibly could, I expected to make saves, and I expected to make good saves, because that's what I did in training. If I practice all them things, then you expect a certain level. So
who would you say were your heroes when you were growing up? Who would you?
Bad Jennings. Yeah, because he did everything with a minimum of fuss and made saves at every part of his body.
Well, if you go back sort of towards the 80s and the 90s, goalkeepers normally used to hit their prime in the later years, and they would be maybe the oldest player on the pitch, whereas these days you do see a lot of these goalkeepers playing at 19, 20 and 21, which is almost unheard of.
I don't see that many.
Well, I mean, they seem to be getting younger then, would you say, compared to in your day. Do you think that, like you said, you've got...
There's three stages. There's your potentially good ones, which Joe Hart was, and I was established himself after a couple of years. Then you get to Brad's stage, where you're a veteran, so you go... Potentially good, established veteran. So it depends what stage you're at, but I look at most of them and go, actually, name me a good young goalkeeper apart from Joe Hart.
Butland?
Who was he playing?
Cheltenham.
Yeah, Cheltenham on loan last year. Mm. So how do you know he's any good? How many times have you seen him?
Not many. No. The Olympics, really, was his showcase.
Yeah, and that was a Mickey Mouse thing. Wasn't it? So... Right, go on after that.
Simon?
That's what I'm saying, so you're saying that.
Well, we had Tom Heaton down at Cardiff, didn't we? We had, speaking of Liverpool goalkeepers, you had David James. He was one of the first, really. Shea Given even started playing at a reasonably young age.
Young, but now, you said now, where are they?
Today. De Gea at Man United, I think he's mid-20s. Well, he's just been dropped, hasn't he?
Yeah,
so to answer the question then, you do agree that, or you do feel that goalkeepers really are only...
I think they're better at 35 than they are at 28.
They need to... It's the position where they really need to cut their...
You need to play games.
Yeah.
And you need to play a lot of games, and I think...
And make mistakes, would you say?
Well, yeah, because you're just as good as your next mistake, aren't you, luckily, in all fairness. But it's how you get over the mistakes as well.
So we only leave the start of the World Cup. How do you think... What do you think of Wales' chances of qualifying?
Pretty good. I don't see why they shouldn't qualify. I just think as a nation we're incredibly negative. Incredibly negative. We've got a good team, we've got a good player, so why shouldn't we qualify?
Where do you think that negativity comes from?
Being Welsh. I think it's a trait. I think Wales like being underdogs. I think the rugby have changed the mentality, and I'd like to see the football change the mentality. And not so much the people on the pitch, but the people off the pitch. It's to change the way we portray our national team. And really they should be coming to people like yourselves and giving you a ticket to say, right, look, take some of your commute in there. You know, here's 100 tickets, take the people that can't afford to go to games normally, take them in and give them some back. And I think that would be nice. They need to fill the ground.
You do talk in the book about death of Gary Speed. How much of an impact in his short reign as manager do you think he had in turning around some of that negative mentality?
Well, I think he's a positive person. I think they displayed a certain amount of arrogance on the pitch, which I was delighted with. They showed an arrogance. They thought, yeah, we're going to beat these. So it didn't matter who was in their way, they were going to try and beat them. And they had a way of playing which was quite open and quite nice to watch. Even though they were quite solid defensively, they actually had a real goal threat and looked to go forward as much as they could. And I think, you know, Chris has got a hard job to follow Gary. In lots of ways, because obviously he's changed the coaching staff. Raymond's gone. I think Raymond was underrated probably, because obviously he had that Dutch arrogance to take in there, which is what you need. So you want to see the players with arrogance. You want to see them believing that they're good players, because if they don't, nobody else is going to. But you want to see it backed up by the FA.
When you talk about world class players on display, say for example, our regular listeners will know that for my sins I'm a bit of a Liverpool supporter.
Yeah, well, you get over it.
Yeah, sorry to say. But in my youth, I mean, I had an immense amount of respect for you personally, and you, for me, gave us, Welsh people, a lot of pride at being able to look at you and say, here's a guy who is Welsh and who is literally one of the best players in that position in the entire world. And at the moment, that is, I think, where we are struggling as a Welsh side, to not have that sort of that confidence and that belief in our players. Where do you see...
So Gareth Bale's not world class.
Well, I was going to say, where do you see those players that are, you know, so up and amongst the best players in the world?
I think they've got terrific players. I just think because of Welsh, we want to be the underdogs. So if we win, it's a historic event. If we lose, maybe expect it. Maybe that comes from not qualifying too much.
We mentioned on the radio when Swansea got promoted to the Premiership that there seemed to be an increase in the belief in the team, and then obviously we had Gary Speed come in as well and really capitalise on that. Obviously, we all know how things have panned out since then. Where do you see the next step for Wales?
Qualifying. Simple as that. Why can't you qualify? I don't get where, well, we might do this. Why can't we just be positive, like we're going to try and qualify? I'd rather be damn trying than damn not trying.
There are a lot of Welsh footballers, say for example, who have chosen to play for other countries when they could have played
Welsh.
For Wales.
I could have played for England. My mum's English. I think my dad would have shot me. But I'm Welsh and I'm proud to be Welsh.
But if for a young footballer who maybe has to make that decision for themselves now, what would your advice be? Go for Wales and take the national pride over anything else?
I would take national pride and I'd take the ability to have a regular game for your country. Why would you want to play 3 caps for England, sit on the bench for 90 games?
But do you have any negative thoughts to people who have decided to follow the success rather than play for who really should be there?
Everybody's got their own choices. Somebody else, who am I going to criticise somebody for going to play for England? Because the ones that have done it, I can't think of many who have been successful.
No, can you? Not really. More successful.
Well, I just think that you have a leaning towards your country. You want to play for your country, whatever the country is, whether it's England or Wales or whatever. You have a leaning towards that. And I think, well, you can be influenced by your parents, but once you make the decision that what you're going to be, then I think you stick with it. And sometimes, look, in life you make a decision, doesn't turn out to be the right one for you, but you stick with it. And now they're trying to change that, maybe the silly rules that they brought in.
Well, how do you feel about Chris Coleman lately trying to tap up players to come and play for Wales?
Good.
Kind of works the other way.
Good. If they want to come and play. It probably makes them less Welsh in a way, but at the end of the day, they want a successful team as well. I'd rather have a team full of proper Welsh people who are desperate to play, but again, I think Chris thinks there's a defect in our team where he can improve it. And he'd be wrong not to actually go down that road, wouldn't he? If you've got your business, you want to improve your business. And that's a problem Welsh football's got. You can't have it both ways. You either want to be successful, and the next success, you have to drag something that you don't like into it.
Would you say that some of your sort of your zeal and your passion about this subject comes from the fact that you yourself came so close to qualifying and it still hasn't yet happened?
No.
Or not at all? Is that just a...
No, it comes from giving people opportunities.
Yeah.
And the kids that I work with have no opportunities.
Tell us about the work you're doing now with disadvantaged kids. You've alluded to it a few times in the interview, but it's obviously something you're very, very passionate about because working really hard with kids who, as you've said in the book, really have nothing, and all they have is people telling them that they're rubbish all the time.
Well, yeah, I'm sick and tired of people telling them they're rubbish. I mean, because what we try and do is I try and make it into a dressing room atmosphere where they are themselves and they're not scared of making mistakes, and we sit down and we try and say, well, look, you are going to make mistakes and we're going to absolutely slaughter you for it, but in a nice way, because we can have a go at you. But anybody outside have a go at you, then we'll stick up for you. And as long as you're fit, and the one thing I did learn was they all want boundaries. They all know where they stand in the world. They all want boundaries. They say, right, okay, I can push you to that far. That's my line there. Go over that and I won't be best pleased. And they go, okay, I can live with that. As long as you don't hold grudges and you're pretty fair with them, you'll get lots out of them.
Is there any link to your background as a footballer or as a sportsman that's brought you into this sort of what you're doing now, or is it just something completely separate and random?
No, I think once you start off, you're led by somebody else. I was lucky when I got in the World Squad, Di Davis always looked after me. When I got into Everton, I had Jim Arnold to actually look at my study, and I had most of the time I had older people, and they really looked after me. But once you become a senior goalkeeper, then I used to do all the warm-ups and I used to take the kids, all the goalkeepers all the time. So I suppose then it's a form of teaching, and you try and work out what the kid's all about. And I don't care who you are, once I get that key and I can turn you and I can get things out of you. So it's about knowing, for me it's about knowing the players, and I think...
So that kind of lit a spark for you, really?
Yeah, I think so, and I was always interested in that. And to be fair, I always, when I was playing, I always read as much as I could on different subjects. I looked at all the different oils I could use, I looked at the different colours. That's why I wear a black shirt, funny enough, because I thought that'd be harder to spot than a bright coloured shirt. Especially at night games where the forward might take an extra second. I read a lot of golf books because, again, their stance is very similar to goalkeeper's stance. I looked at the boxing ones because you have to learn to punch. I looked at the gymnastics ones because you have to be a gymnast. I looked at the weightlifting ones because you have to be part of a weightlifter. I looked at all the cricket court wicket keepers. I looked at the hockey goalies. And I looked at all the different sports. I looked at different foods and different colours. So I tried to look at different music. And I tried to look at everything that would give me an edge. There's a lot of information out there.
Do you feel that you're in a way ahead of your time, really? Because this is the sort of thing that people are bringing into the sport now, a lot of different sciences.
Yeah, but they call it something else now, don't they? Psychology, whatever you want to call it. But I think because you're on your own, you either want to be the best that you can, or you just want to go along with the flow. And I tried to be the best what I could be, because I didn't want to really go back to old Canyon, in all fairness. And I want to be successful in what I did, and I think sometimes... I always thought, if I get up in the morning and I don't train well, somebody else down the road is training better than me, and he's going to be better than me. And I think you can see, especially in the Olympics now, how much time and effort they put in with nobody watching them.
So all of this relationship building skills that you have, and reading people skills, and your knowledge of sport, and your thirst for knowledge, does this lead you to maybe being the manager of the Welsh national team one day?
No, I've got no chance. No, me and the Welsh, if I don't get wrong. There's no chance of that, mate. I'm happy.
Or into management in general? Is it something that you're interested in?
I want to work with the kids.
Obviously, you spent a lot of time at Everton, and you know, when people think of you, they think of Everton very often. And I was just wondering, with how do you see things happening as they are at the moment at Everton? Last year, obviously, they managed to finish. It was a big season for derbies, wasn't it, with Manchester United and Manchester City? And one of the big ones was Everton finishing above Liverpool as well.
Yeah, I think that'll happen again this year. I think Everton will finish fourth. I think they'll do really, really well this year. I think they've added goals, Angelic to the squad, and then they've got Naismith, and they've got Kennedy from Kilmarnock. So I think he always looks to buy somebody who's young and upcoming, but he's got his established players as well. And I think if Angelic can be the first player to score 20 goals.
And it's a very different way of achieving success with David Moyes, isn't it? Because of the amount of the sort of money that gets thrown around these days in football, and he does it from a different approach. I mean, how do you feel about this? There's talk about new rules coming in now to govern sort of how much money teams are allowed to spend. I mean, are you one of those people that are very against the financial setup of clubs in modern day football?
No, I think you have to cut your costs accordingly. I think Everton, the best thing Everton did last year was come out and say they had no money. Everyone, yeah, all right, at least you're telling us the truth. I think they've had issues down here at Cardiff where nobody knows what money they've got and what money they haven't got. And I think if people come out and say, look, actually, we've got no money, people go, oh, okay, fair enough. Well, we've got this much debt. Oh, we can cope with that. As long as you tell us the truth, people can cope. Once you start trying to hide things, then people don't like it. So you might as well tell them the truth, whether they like it or not. At least they you know they've been honest. And as for the new rules aren't going to work. Mm. But they're not going to work, are they? Because they'll find a way around it.
So you feel, but do you agree with them in principle, or do you like seeing the?
I'd like to see everybody on the same money.
You would.
Yeah, I think give them a fair day's whack. Everybody on the same money, but that ain't gonna happen either, is it? In a new utopia, people will all be paid the same money, and all have the same level playing field. Well, you know for a start that it's not a level playing field because Swansea are never going to be Man United. They're never going to be Man City. They're never going to be Liverpool. They're never going to be Chelsea, are they? Without that incredible backer. And I think if you say, well, can only spend this much, they'll find other ways. Are you technically going to give somebody a house for £2 million? You're not spending money, are you? You just... So I think there's going to be ways around it. And I would love to see what they do in the rugby sometimes, where they say 50% of your gate is or 50% of your income must go on wages, and that's it. Not more than 50%. I think that'd be a good way of doing it.
So your career obviously spanned quite a lot of change in football, from how it was in the 80s and how it came into the sort of Premiership era. Did you notice a change in footballers themselves as colleagues, you know, at the early part of your career into the late part of your career, and in some ways how they are now?
Well, they're different animals now, aren't they? Because they have the power. When I started off, I remember asking Howard for £5 a week rise, and he says, bugger off, get out the door. So they wouldn't even entertain me. That was after the first season. I thought, right, okay, cheers. But I think there's a change. The main change was that we couldn't play at the times we wanted to play at. There's one guy come in and said, right, you're playing Sunday, 4 o'clock. Well, that's not real time, is it? Sunday's a family time, most of the time, and it's disrupted loads of families, I think, and it still does, you know. Monday, who wants to watch football on a Monday night? All right, the telly's rubbish, but you want people to listen to your radio station, don't you? You want people to actually listen to other things and do other things during the week. There's so much football now, I think it's saturated it. And to be fair, I don't watch much of it. I watch it if Everton play, or if somebody I like playing, or somebody I know is playing, but I wouldn't go out my way to watch it.
Because there's so much on.
Well, yeah, because I can go with Japanese league, Italian league, Australian league, Bundesliga, our league, Nationwide League. You think all this football is brilliant, or women's league as well. You can only watch so much before you go, actually, this is boring. And I think people get bored with it. And I think where it used to be on a Saturday, and you used to watch match a day, it was brilliant. Then we go, oh, watch match a day, and then a Sunday afternoon on ITV, and that was enough. On midweek, you should maybe show highlights, but I think that was enough. Like the way it is now, it's just shoved in your face all the time, and it's, you can see when, I know you do community radio, there's going to be a time when none of your community can afford, going to have to pay for everything that they watch, and that can't be right either. No, I don't think it's right. I think television's for everybody, not just for pay-per-view all the time, and it shouldn't be penalised because you haven't got the money to pay for the pay-per-view event. It should be free to everybody all the time, and they make enough money on the adverts, don't they? And they give enough money to football clubs, but they should rein some in and give it to the community.
Well, we really appreciate your time today. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us, and we've definitely enjoyed listening to your views on everything from your career, politics, and everything. But best of luck with the book as well.
Thank you.
And we really hope that your work can certainly bring about a lot of change as well, because it's certainly very, very positive. So thank you very much.
Cheers. Thank you.
Thank you for downloading the Radio Cardiff Sport Podcast. For more information about the show, go to our blog,
radiocardiffsport.blogspot.com.